Chapter 29. Herself, though boats were seen going to and from her at night, and that she was seen standing out of the mouth of the harbor, in the gray of the dawn, after the catastrophe of the money diggers. 1. A piratical vessel. I must not omit to mention another report, also, which I confess is rather apocryphal, of the buccaneer who is supposed to have been drowned, being seen before daybreak, with a lantern in his hand, seated astride of his great sea chest, and sailing through Hell Gate, which just then began to roar and bellow with redoubled fury. While all the gossip world was thus filled with talk and rumor, poor Wolford lay sick and sorrowfully in his bed, bruised in body and sorely beaten down in mind. His wife and daughter did all they could to bind up his wounds, both corporal and spiritual. The good old dame never stirred from his bedside, where she sat knitting from morning till night, while his daughter busied herself about him with the fondest care. Nor did they lack assistance from abroad. Whatever may be said of the desertion of friends in distress, they had no complaint of the kind to make. Not an old wife of the neighborhood, but abandoned her work to crowd to the mansion of Wolford Webber, to inquire after his health and the particulars of his story. Not one came, moreover, without her little pipkin of paneer oil, sage, balm, or other herb tea, delighted at an opportunity of signalizing her kindness and her doctorship. What drenchings did not the poor Wolford undergo, and all in vain? It was a moving sight to behold him wasting away day by day, growing thinner and thinner and ghastlier, and staring with rueful visage from under an old patchwork counterpane, upon the jury of matrons kindly assembled to sigh and groan and look unhappy around him. Dirk Waldron was the only being that seemed to shed a ray of sunshine into this house of mourning. He came in with cheery look and manly spirit, and tried to reanimate the expiring heart of the poor money digger, but it was all in vain. Wolford was completely done over. 1. If anything was wanting to complete his despair, it was a notice, served upon him in the midst of his distress, that the corporation was about to run a new street through the very center of his cabbage garden. He now saw nothing before him but poverty and ruin. His last reliance, the garden of his forefathers, was to be laid waste, and what then was to become of his poor wife and child? 1. Exhausted. His eyes filled with tears as they followed the dutiful Amy out of the room one morning. Dirk Waldron was seated beside him. Wolford grasped his hand, pointed after his daughter, and for the first time since his illness broke the silence he had maintained. "I am going," said he, shaking his head feebly, "and when I am gone, my poor daughter, leave her to me." "Father," said Dirk manfully, "I'll take care of her." Wolford looked up in the face of the cheery, strapping youngster, and saw there was none better able to take care of a woman. "Enough," said he, "she is yours. And now fetch me a lawyer, let me make my will and die." The lawyer was brought, a dapper, bustling, round-headed little man, Rurbach, or Olibic, as it was pronounced, by name. At the sight of him the women broke into loud lamentations, for they looked upon the signing of a will as the signing of a death warrant. Wolford made a feeble motion for them to be silent. Poor Amy buried her face and her grief in the bed curtain. Dom Webber resumed her knitting to hide her distress, which betrayed itself, however, in a pellucid tear, which trickled silently down and hung at the end of her peaked nose, while the cat, the only unconcerned member of the family, played with the good dame's ball of worsted as it rolled about the floor. Wolford lay on his back, his nightcap drawn over his forehead, his eyes closed, his whole visage the picture of death. He begged the lawyer to be brief, for he felt his end approaching, and that he had no time to lose. The lawyer nibbed, 1, his pen, spread out his paper, and prepared to write. 1, in Irving's time, quills were made in two pens, by pointing or nibbing their ends. "I give and bequeath," said Wolford faintly, "my small farm." "What? All?" exclaimed the lawyer. Wolford half opened his eyes and looked upon the lawyer. "Yes, all," said he. What, all that great patch of land with cabbages and sunflowers, which the corporation is just going to run a main street through? The same, said Wolfert, with a heavy sigh, and sinking back upon his pillow. I wish him joy that inherits it, said the little lawyer, chuckling and rubbing his hands involuntarily. What do you mean? Said Wolfert, again opening his eyes. That he'll be one of the richest men in the place, cried little Rollebuck. The expiring Wolfert seemed to step back from the threshold of existence. His eyes again lighted up. He raised himself in his bed, shoved back his red worsted nightcap, and stared broadly at the lawyer. You don't say so, exclaimed he. Faith, but I do, rejoined the other. Aye, when that great field and that huge meadow come to be laid out in streets and cut up into snug building lots, why, whoever owns it need not pull off his hat to the patroon. Say you so? Cried Wolfert, half thrusting one leg out of bed. Why, then, I think I'll not make my will yet. To the surprise of everybody, the dying man actually recovered. The vital spark, which had glimmered faintly in the socket, received fresh fuel from the oil of gladness which the little lawyer poured into his soul. It once more burned up into a flame. Give physic to the heart, ye who would revive the body of a spirit-broken man. In a few days Wolfert left his room. In a few days more his table was covered with deeds, plans of streets and building lots. Little Rollebuck was constantly with him, his right-hand man and advisor, and instead of making his will assisted in the more agreeable task of making his fortune. In fact, Wolfert Weber was one of those worthy Dutch burghers of the Manhattoes whose fortunes have been made, in a manner, in spite of themselves, who have tenaciously held on to their hereditary acres, raising turnips and cabbages about the skirts of the city, hardly able to make both ends meet, until the corporation has cruelly driven streets through their abodes, and they have suddenly awakened out of their lethargy, and, to their astonishment, found themselves rich men. Before many months had elapsed, a great, bustling street passed through the very center of the Weber Garden, just where Wolfert had dreamed of finding a treasure. His golden dream was accomplished. He did, indeed, find an unlooked-for source of wealth, for, when his paternal lands were distributed in two building lots, and rented out to safe tenants, instead of producing a paltry crop of cabbages they returned him an abundant crop of rent, insomuch that on quarter day it was a goodly sight, to see his tenants knocking at the door from morning till night, each with a little round-bellied bag of money, a golden produce of the soil. The ancient mansion of his forefathers was still kept up, but, instead of being a little yellow-fronted Dutch house in a garden, it now stood boldly in the midst of a street, the grand home of the neighborhood. For Wolfert enlarged it with a wing on each side, and a cupola tea room on top, where he might climb up and smoke his pipe in hot weather, and in the course of time the whole mansion was overrun by the chubby-faced progeny of Amy Weber and Dirk Waldron. As Wolfert waxed old, and rich and corpulent, he also set up a great gingerbread-colored carriage, drawn by a pair of black Flanders mares with tails, that swept the ground. And to commemorate the origin of his greatness, he had for his crest a full-blown cabbage painted on the panels, with the pithy motto, Al's K.O.P.F., that is to say, all head, meaning thereby that he had risen by sheer head work. To fill the measure of his greatness, in the fullness of time the renowned Ram Rapelius slept with his fathers, and Wolfert Weber succeeded to the leather-bottomed armchair in the inn parlor at Corlier's Hook, where he long reigned, greatly honored and respected, insomuch that he was never known to tell a story without its being believed, nor to utter a joke without its being laughed at. Introduction to Ireland's Madness, from Ireland, or the Transformation. From virtue's blissful paths away the double-tongued are sure to stray, good is a forthright journey still, and mazy paths, but lead to ill. Wyland is the first American novel. It appeared in 1798. Its author was soon recognized as the earliest American novelist. and he remained the greatest, until Fenimore Cooper brought forth his Leather Stocking Tales, a quarter of a century later. Although modern sophistication easily points out flaws in Charles Brockden Brown's story structure, and reproves him for improbability, morbidness, and a style often too elevated, yet his work lives. His downright originality is worthy of Cooper himself, and his weird imaginations and horribly sustained scenes of terror have been surpassed by few writers, save Edgar Allan Poe. Charles Brockden Brown, First Part, I, Wieland's Madness. As the story opens, the narratress, Clara Wieland, is entering upon the happy realization of her love for Henry Pleyel, closest friend of her brother Ireland. Their woodland home, Mettingen, on the banks of the then remote Schuylkill, is the abode of music, letters and thorough culture. The peace of high-thinking and simple outdoor life hovers over all. One sunny afternoon I was standing in the door of my house, when I marked a person passing close to the edge of the bank that was in front. His pace was a careless and lingering one, and had none of that gracefulness and ease which distinguish a person with certain advantages of education from a clown. His gait was rustic and awkward. His form was ungainly and disproportioned. Shoulders broad and square, breast sunken, his head drooping, his body of uniform breadth, supported by long and lank legs, were the ingredients of his frame. His garb was not ill adapted to such a figure. A slouched hat, tarnished by the weather, a coat of thick gray cloth, cut and wrought, as it seemed, by a country tailor, blue worsted stockings, and shoes fastened by thongs and deeply discolored by dust, which brush had never disturbed, constituted his dress. There was nothing remarkable in these appearances. They were frequently to be met with on the road and in the harvest field. I cannot tell why I gazed upon them, on this occasion, with more than ordinary attention, unless it were that such figures were seldom seen by me except on the road or field. This lawn was only traversed by men whose views were directed to the pleasures of the walk, or the grandeur of the scenery. He passed slowly along, frequently pausing, as if to examine the prospect more deliberately, but never turning his eye toward the house, so as to allow me a view of his countenance. Presently he entered a copse at a small distance, and disappeared. My eye followed him, while he remained in sight. If his image remained for any duration in my fancy after his departure, it was because no other object occurred sufficient to expel it. I continued in the same spot for half an hour, vaguely, and by fits, contemplating the image of this wanderer, and drawing from outward appearances those inferences, with respect to the intellectual history of this person, which experience affords us. I reflected on the alliance which commonly subsists between ignorance and the practice of agriculture, and indulged myself in airy speculations, as to the influence of progressive knowledge in dissolving this alliance, and embodying the dreams of the poets. I asked why the plow and the hoe might not become the trade of every human being, and how this trade might be made conducive to, or at least consistent with, the acquisition of wisdom and eloquence. Weary with these reflections, I returned to the kitchen, to perform some household office. I had usually but one servant, and she was a girl about my own age. I was busy near the chimney, and she was employed near the door of the apartment, when someone knocked. The door was opened by her, and she was immediately addressed with, "Prithee, good girl, canst thou supply a thirsty man with a glass of buttermilk?" She answered that there was none in the house. "Aye, but there is some in the dairy yonder. Thou knowest as well as I, though Hermes never taught thee, that, though every dairy be a house, every house is not a dairy." To this speech, though she understood only a part of it, she replied by repeating her assurances that as he had none to give. "Well then," rejoined the stranger, "for charity's sweet sake, hand me forth a cup of cold water." The girl said she would go to the spring and fetch it. "Nay, give me the cup, and suffer me to help myself. Neither manacled nor lame, I should merit burial in the maw of carrion crows, if I laid this task upon thee." She gave him the cup, and he turned to go to the spring. I listened to this dialogue in silence. The words uttered by the person without affected me as somewhat singular, but what chiefly rendered them remarkable was the tone that accompanied them. It was wholly new. My brother's voice and playals were musical and energetic. I had fondly imagined that, in this respect, they were surpassed by none. Now my mistake was detected. I cannot pretend to communicate the impression that was made upon me by these accents, or to depict the degree in which force and sweetness were blended in them. They were articulated with a distinctness that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.